So this evening we'll continue what we started last evening. Some of the people here now weren't here yesterday. That's okay. You'll still pick up as much as you can, and I'll do a little bit of review. Yeah, and this is a difficult subject to start with, talking about the nature of reality. But I do want to, I had told you yesterday that Nagarjuna set out this very beautiful kind of proof of the existence of the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and of the four truths and so on. And so I do want to get into that today. And even if it's not perfectly crystal clear, it plants seeds. And one of the big things that we try and do in our practice is plant seeds, in the sense that we learn different things, become familiar with them gradually. Yeah. And so at the beginning, we may not understand it, but there's a seed planted. And then as the next time comes around, we can get more understanding, and then the next time more understanding, and so on. Okay. So yesterday I had also mentioned that we at the Abbey, that we try, you know, when we can, to set English translations of various prayers and requests to melodies that, to melodies. And some of them are melodies we already know, some of them are ones we make up. And so we're going to do the one that there's a prayer that's the homage to Manjushri. So we'll chant that. Manjushri is the Buddha of wisdom. And just in terms of how he looks, his body is a red-yellow. So I guess that means kind of a golden orange. He's sitting cross-legged. His left hand is holding the stem of a lotus flower that blossoms at his ear, and it has on it the text of the Prajnaparamita. And then his right hand, oh, there he is, holding the sword. It's a double-edged sword and with fire on it. And the sword represents cutting through all wrong views. And because it's double-edged, it's wrong views about conventional truth, wrong views about ultimate truth. Okay. He's in a very peaceful form. And yet when you do the practice, you can see that with the mantra and the practice, your wisdom is getting clearer. In other words, a lot of the murkiness in our mind that prevents us from understanding gets cleared up. Yeah, so it's quite beautiful. The prayer that we're going to, the homage that we're going to chant now is in Tibetan. It's called Gong Lama, and it's one that's very popular. And before the monks and nuns do their debating in the evening, this is a prayer that they chant. And often when His Holiness Dalai Lama is teaching one of Nagarjuna's texts or one of the texts on wisdom, everybody will chant this. So it's quite beautiful. There's no real time to explain it, but I think you can pick something up from it. Okay, so we'll do this, And then we'll do the mandala offering, which is thinking of the universe and everything beautiful in it, and offering that to the Buddha Dharma Sangha and requesting teachings. Yeah, because it's very important. In the Buddhist tradition, we're supposed to request teachings. Yeah, now it's kind of done in a funny way. Dharma centers request the teaching, and then they post flyers about it, and then people come. Yeah, but actually, we do the mandala offering usually before every session of a teaching to request the teaching, and to by doing so, by offering the universe and everything beautiful in it, we're illustrating that the Dharma is more valuable than the universe and everything in it. Yeah, why? Because the universe is transient, it comes, it goes, it's in the nature of dukkha, yeah? And there's no happiness to be found in the ordinary universe under the control of afflictions and karma. So we're willing to offer that, yeah, in order to receive the teachings that then when we practice will lead us to liberation and to full awakening. Yeah. So it helps us, doing the mandala offering helps us remember that this is, that the Dharma is precious and we shouldn't just take it for granted. And then we'll do the refuge and bodhicitta prayer after that. Okay, have a few minutes of silent meditation and generate our motivation. And I notice people are sitting in very perfect straight rows, which is resulting in some people not being able to see the speaker. So don't tell anybody, but feel free to move. You don't have to be in a straight row. It's more important that you're able to see the speaker. Okay. So especially the people sitting in this row. Like that. Okay. Okay. So when we do the prayer to Manjushri, we imagine, we visualize Manjushri in the space in front of us as we're chanting it. And then let's cultivate our motivation. So as a Buddha, Manjushri has made the vow to work for the benefit of each and every sentient being and lead them to awakening, full awakening. And so like all the other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, that pledge, that determination, that promise to benefit us is unshakable. So if Manjushri and all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have pledged never to give up on us, never to say, oh, so-and-so, whatever your name is, they're just too much, and give up their compassion and their willingness to benefit them. If they will never do that, then we should also try to have a motivation similar to theirs. And even if we don't have it in an uncontrived way, at least to generate it in a contrived way so that we open our heart in compassion to each and every living being. And we see the meaning and purpose of our life as following the path to awakening, so that we can develop the qualities such as compassion and wisdom and skillful means that will enable us to be of the greatest benefit to sentient beings. So let's generate that motivation now, so that our motivation and Manjushri's motivation, the Buddha's motivation, are all in sync together. So when I consider the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas as having that kind of determination to benefit us and not just get fed up and say, forget it, that really makes me pause and look at my attitude towards other living beings. Do I have that same kind of love and compassion? Obviously not. But, you know, it's important to cultivate that. Yeah. And to keep generating it again and again and again. And I think that generating that again repeatedly really makes us stop and think, how do I treat other sentient beings? Do I treat them respectfully? Am I willing to stick with them even when they behave abominably? Or am I quick to, with a temper, and somebody does something I don't like, and like, forget it, get out of here. And I start calling them a bunch of names. Yeah. Because, you know, if I want to learn from the Buddha, I should try and have developed some of the qualities like the Buddha. Yeah. And not just think, I want what I want when I want it. And the whole world is here to give me what I want. And if I don't get it, I'm going to get angry and blame other people. Yeah. Unfortunately, this is the way many sentient beings act. Yeah. But having heard the Dharma, we should really do what we can to avoid that kind of motivation, you know, and try and really see with our heart that everybody wants happiness and not suffering as much as we do. Yeah, so there's no reason why we are more important and worthy than everybody else. Yeah. We're quite fortunate in having met the Buddhist teaching, whereas other people haven't. But that's nothing to get proud of. Okay? That's a benefit that we have that we should really take to heart and use. Okay? So we will continue somewhere with where we left off yesterday. So, emptiness or selflessness is a negative phenomena, not negative as in non-virtuous, but negative in the sense that it is an absence. It's a lack of something. You know, so the book is a positive phenomena. There's something here. Yeah. But if I say there's the absence or this room is empty of an elephant, the emptiness of an elephant doesn't look any different. We can't find it. It's just the lack of an elephant. Okay? So emptiness is the lack or the absence or the non-existence of inherent existence. An inherent existence is a very solid, objectified existence that our ignorance imputes on ourselves, on other people, on everything. Okay? And because we've been imputing this false way of existence since beginningless time, we're very familiar with it. It happens all the time. We don't even notice that we're doing it. And it's even begun, you know, it even affects our senses so that everything we see appears to have its own essence, its own nature, something that makes it what it is. Okay, so yesterday, remember, we were talking about the cup and trying to find out what the cup really is. It looks like there's something here that has the nature of a cup. But if we try and point out what that is, we can't find anything. Okay? And so it goes with everything. Yeah? What's the bell or the gong? Yeah? Is it the shape? Is it the material? Is it the color? Is it the bottom? Is it the top? What is it? We can't find one part of it, or, you know, that is the gong. And even the collection is not the gong, because the collection is a bunch of things that aren't a gong. Okay? Each part is not a gong, so the collection of parts can't be a gong. It's like, you know, each orange is an orange, and a collection of oranges is not going to be an apple. Yeah, it's, you know, that's it. It's just a collection of oranges. Nothing of them is an orange. Okay, so when we are learning about emptiness and meditating on it, there's two extremes that it's very easy to fall to. Okay, one extreme is called the extreme of superimposition, or the extreme of existence, of permanence. There's several different names. I call it absolutism, okay, in the sense that what it means is inherent existence. So when we're trying to find emptiness, the absence of inherent existence, one extreme is grasping at inherent existence and saying, it's there, things really do exist this way, I'm sure of it. Okay? When I see Amitabha Buddhist Center, it is Amitabha Buddhist Center. That's it. Yeah? It's not a giraffe. It's not granola. Yeah? There's something here that is ABC. But what is it? Yeah? Yeah? What is ABC? Is it the building? Is it the people? Is it the outside? Is the inside? Okay. The extreme of superimposition or absolutism grasps that, yes, there is something that is really, truly Amitabha Buddhist Center. Okay. That's one extreme. The other extreme is nihilism. Yeah. In other words, people misunderstanding emptiness, which is a negation of inherent existence, and going way, way too far and saying, well, nothing exists. Nothing exists. Yeah. So everything we're seeing is actually totally non-existent. Yeah. That's kind of not very realistic, is it? Yeah. We know from our own experience things exist. So we talk about the middle way view, yeah, as avoiding those two extremes, the extreme of absolutism or inherent existence, the extreme of nihilism or total non-existence. Yeah. Most people in the world fall to the extreme of absolutism, grasping inherent existence as true. Some people, when they start to research, you know, what is something and they can't find it, then they go to the extreme, they fall to the extreme of nihilism and say, well, nothing exists. Okay, both of them are extremes. When we talk about emptiness, you know, being the middle way, or the wisdom realizing emptiness being the middle way, it doesn't mean that we take absolutism, nihilism, add them together, cut them in half, and that's the middle way. Okay? It means, you know, it has, don't visualize it as a line, and here's one, here's the other, and the middle way is here. The middle way view is completely different from grasping inherent existence and grasping total non-existence. Okay. So it's not half and half. Yeah. It's totally different from them. Because when we have the correct view, we realize that although things lack any objective or inherent existence, they still exist dependently. Okay, and so this is the most difficult part to realize, to negate the inherent existence, but establish just conventional existence. Yeah. So it's quite subtle and it's very difficult. And I only know the words about it. I have no experience of it. But it's, you know, when you start to look at things, you know, from the viewpoint of emptiness and dependent arising, then you get some feeling that, yeah, things are empty, but they arise dependently, and that those two things are not contradictory. Because things arise dependently, they do not exist inherently. Because things are empty of inherent existence, they arise dependent on other factors. So yesterday I talked a little bit about some of the other factors that people and phenomena are dependent on. So one is their causes and conditions. Yeah, and remember I posed the question to you yesterday, do you feel as if you are here only because the causes of you are here? That without the causes of you, you wouldn't be here? Do you feel like that at all? No, we feel, I'm here. But who's that I that's here? It's not the body. It's not the mind. It's not something separate from them. But we feel like there's something that is really, truly me. Yeah. And that grasping at that, you know, this solid me really creates so many problems in our life. Yeah. Because if there's a solid me, yeah, then my happiness is really crucial. And my suffering is also very important. And then that leads us directly into clinging attachment and wanting to get what we want, no matter what we have to do get it. And it leads us into anger because, you know, other people or circumstances interfere with us getting what we want. So we get upset. And then, you know, we live in a world of confusion. And, you know, we go back and forth between confusion, attachment, anger, you know, back and forth with some other kinds of anger like spite and belligerence and rebelliousness mixed in, and other kinds of attachment like greed and craving and clinging, yeah, and other things like that. And then we have so many problems. Yeah, when you look at your life, where do your problems come from? Yeah, I'll give you a hint. It's not other people. You look at me and you're going, oh yeah? You don't know this person did this to me and that person did that and this and that. All my problems come from other people. Yeah. And the whole problem with the universe is I know how to run it and nobody else cooperates. Right? Yeah? So my ideas are always right. Yeah? In fact, I don't have opinions. Yeah? I know what is true. Yeah? They aren't opinions that are subjective. If I think it, it is true. And if I change my mind and think something else tomorrow, that one is true. Even if it contradicts what I'm thinking today. Yeah. And then everybody who doesn't agree with me is just too stupid beyond belief. Yeah. And the problem with the world is I give people advice and they don't listen. In fact, they have the nerve to say, mind your own business. They say that to me. How dare they? Yeah. I know what is true. They should listen. But I'm not conceited or anything. No, I'm not arrogant. I just am right. That's all. Yeah. Whenever you have an argument with somebody, yeah, are you ever wrong? Never. Never. Yeah, we're always right. Yeah, especially in your family, yeah, you have a quarrel with somebody in your family, yeah. Are you ever wrong? Never. Yeah, we're always right. Why? Because whatever I believe is right. Why? Because I am I. I'm me. And one rule of the universe is that I'm right. Yeah. So don't quarrel with me. Just shut up and do what I say. Cause some problems in your life, this attitude? Yeah? It sure does. And it's all based on misapprehending how we exist and thinking that there's some solid, truly existent thing that is me. That's the source of the whole problem. Okay, so this is why learning about emptiness is important. Thank you for protecting us. We wish you well. We wish that you didn't have to fly fighter jets over the country. Yeah, we wish that everybody could get along. Okay. So also just the point where we left off yesterday was that realizing emptiness is the only way to attain nirvana, okay, an awakening. Yeah, that we learn many, many Dharma teachings. You know, we learn the antidotes to anger, we learn the antidotes to jealousy, the antidotes to attachment. You know, there's so many antidotes that are specific to different afflictions, okay? And those antidotes work when we develop them and are familiar with them, okay? But they only temporarily subdue one of the afflictions we have. They don't have the power to cut it. For example, if I have a lot of attachment and I'm wanting something, yeah, then if I remember impermanence and that whatever it is I'm craving and wanting, that it's going to be in existence and then it's going to go out of existence, then that really helps my craving decrease. Because, you know, why am I saying, I want for something that is not going to be here forever? Okay. So that the antidote of impermanence is good for counteracting attachment temporarily, but that antidote doesn't cut the root of our samsara. It doesn't cut the ignorance that grasps to a true existence. Okay, so that's why we have to always, that the key to liberation is that wisdom. That doesn't mean that learning all the other antidotes and learning all the other aspects of Dharma is useless. No, quite the opposite. We learn all those other things because it's going to take us a while to realize emptiness. You know, like a few eons maybe. So it's good if we have some other antidotes to use on our mind. Yeah. And also because attaining awakening it involves really changing a lot of things in us. Yeah. And the Dalai Lama says that our mind is a very complex and complicated thing. So just one meditation method is not going to solve all of the craziness inside of us. We need many different kinds of meditation. Yeah? And so that's why, you know, the Buddha taught many kinds of meditation and we learn many kinds. Okay. So, yeah. So I never read that quote from the King of Concentration Sutra yesterday, did I? I think I got to that and then the time was up. So the quote says, if phenomena are individually analyzed as selfless, and if what has been analyzed is meditated on, that is the cause for attaining the fruit, nirvana. Through any other cause, one does not go to peace. Peace is a synonym for nirvana. Okay. And so it's saying if we analyze things and we see that they are selfless, and then habituate ourselves through meditation on what we have learned, what selflessness is, then that is the cause for nirvana. Okay. So, well, I'm going to take up reading from, skip a little bit so we can get to the juicy part. So the view of superimposition, that's the view of absolutism, where we're superimposing inherent existence on everything, and inherent existence doesn't exist. So the view of superimposition exaggerates what exists by saying that the dependent arisings exist inherently. Okay. So things that are dependent arisings depend on other factors. Things that exist, if inherent existence actually existed, then nothing would depend on other factors. Okay, everything would have its own way of being, independent of causes and conditions, independent of parts, independent of the mind that conceives and designates them. But everything depends on those things. Yeah. So this view of superimposition or absolutism is faulty because if things existed inherently, they would be independent of all other factors, such as causes and conditions, parts, and so forth. In this case, the person would be permanent because it would exist without depending on causes and conditions. Such an independent, permanent self would continue unchanged eternally after death. Do you feel like you're permanent? That you don't change at all? Sometimes we feel that way. But when you look at it, are we permanent or are you changing? We're changing, aren't we? In fact, we're different people than at the beginning of the talk. We're different people than we were yesterday. Yeah? From moment to moment, like this, we're changing. Okay? But if we existed inherently, independent of other factors, like causes, then we would be permanent. Okay? Then the view of nihilism is also called the view of deprecation. Deprecation means you're cutting something down, okay? You're cutting something down that actually exists. So the view of deprecation or nihilism denies the existence of what does exist. Okay, so superimposition, absolutism, imposes or imputes a kind of existence on things that don't have that way of existence. And the other extreme of nihilism or deprecation denies the existence of things that do exist. So you can see those two views are kind of opposite. So the view of nihilism involves thinking that if a phenomena did not exist inherently, then it would not exist at all. So those who hold this view say that if the inherent existence of impermanent, dependently arising things were negated, then those things could not perform the functions of creating effects. In that case, when the person dies, he or she would become totally non-existent, there being no continuity of the person and thus no rebirth. Okay, so absolutism, inherent existence, yeah, freezes things into, you know, if they existed that way, they would be permanent, they would never change. Okay, and so in terms of rebirth, that would mean that there was some permanent soul or self, some Atma, yeah, that went from one life to the next. Yeah, so the body would die, the mind would dissipate, but the soul would, you know, go on and go into some other body. Okay, that's not how things exist. Yeah, because we're changing all the time, we're not permanent. Yeah. And there's rebirth, but if a permanent person were reborn, it would be exactly the same person as the one who died. Yeah. And that's not how rebirth works. Okay. On the other hand, yeah, the nihilists say, well, if there's no concrete soul or self that goes from one life to the next, then when a person dies, yeah, basta finito, there's nothing that goes on to the next life. Yeah. So this is the view of many scientists who say, you know, that the mind and the brain are separate, and when you die, the body's dying, there's nothing that continues to the next life. Okay. And that also is an incorrect view, because the mind is changing moment by moment by moment by moment. And there's nothing that can stop that continuity of mind. Okay? The continuity of this piece of paper can be stopped. We can burn it, we can tear it up. But so right now, the paper, one moment of the paper produces the next. Okay, but we can destroy this car, this piece of paper altogether. Okay, but the continuity of our consciousness can never be destroyed forever, because there's nothing that could destroy it. However, from moment to moment, it changes. It's not the same. Okay. So both extremes are based on the premise that if phenomena existed, they must exist inherently. And if they don't exist inherently, then they don't exist at all. Okay, those adhering to the view of absolutism say that since phenomena exist, they must exist inherently. Otherwise, they would be totally non-existent, and that is not acceptable. Those holding the view of deprecation or nihilism assert that since phenomena don't exist inherently, they don't exist at all. People who fall to either of these extremes are unable to establish dependently arising phenomena. Okay, so when we meditate on emptiness, it's crucial that first we have a correct conceptual understanding of what emptiness is. Okay? Because otherwise we hear the word empty, and what's our usual, what do we think of usually empty as empty? Well, my refrigerator is empty. Okay, my bank account is empty. Yeah, that's what we think of emptiness is. Yeah, that's not the kind of emptiness that we're trying to develop here. Okay, let's see. Well, there's so much in here. How can I skip any of it? And we don't have all night to go through it. Oh, okay. Well, we'll just continue on here, and I may not get to that part that I talked, that I primed you with. Okay, so the next section is emptiness, its nature, its purpose, and its meaning. Okay, so why in the, what is emptiness, and why should we be concerned with it? Okay, so the nature of emptiness is the mere negation of grasping inherent existence. Okay, so remember at the beginning I said it's a negation, it's the absence of something. So there's nothing positive to hold on to. Yeah. So the purpose of teaching emptiness is to eliminate that grasping that lies at the root of all afflictions and thus of all of our dukkha, all of our unsatisfactory experiences, all of our pain and misery. The meaning of emptiness is that all phenomena lack inherent existence and exist dependently. So those two things, they're empty and they exist dependently. Yeah, those two things go together. So the nature of emptiness is the absence of an objectified basis for grasping. Okay, so remember I told you there's lots of new vocabulary, so here's some of it. Okay, objectified basis. Objectified means inherently existent, something that is objectified. It's out there, yeah, separate from my mind, separate from anything else. So an objectified basis is something that we think is inherently existent. Yeah. And so we grasp it as existing in that way. So the nature of emptiness is the absence of an objectified basis for grasping. That is, anything in relation to which we could say, this is the self. Okay? So can you point to anything that is you? Oh, you can't? I see you. So there's a double, there's two ways in which you can say, can you point to anything that is you? Okay. I mean, I look over here, I see Venerable Dzogchen. That's okay. Yeah? Everybody see her? She exists, right? But if I were to search with ultimate analysis, asking, what really is Venerable Dzogchen? Then, what would I point to? Yeah, she's not her hair. She doesn't have very much. Yeah, she's not her head. She's not her feet. She's not her mind. I can't find something that is her when I search to find some objectified real thing. Okay. But when I don't analyze and I don't search, I can say she's sitting there, and that's true. Everybody accepts that. Okay? That's dependent arising. Hmm? Okay. So anything in relation to which we could say, this is the person, or this is such and such a phenomena. Okay. In his commentary on Bodhicitta, which is the text His Holiness is going to be teaching in Bodh Gaya at the end of the month, Nagarjuna says, the abiding of a mind that has no object is defined as the characteristic of space. So they accept that meditation on emptiness is, in fact, a meditation on space. With the lion's roar of emptiness, all false pronouncements are frightened. Wherever such speakers reside, their emptiness lies in wait. Now, we read that verse and we, you know, go, what in the world is this guy saying? Yeah. We understand some words, maybe a little bit of it, but it's like, I don't really get it. And this is why we need to study, yeah, why meditation is alone is not sufficient. Yeah, because we need to learn what to meditate on, and we need to learn how to meditate. So meditation on emptiness isn't just I sit down and I close my mind, close my eyes, and I close my mind too, and I don't think of anything. Yeah, blank mind. Yeah, total blank mind. Yeah, is that wisdom? That's not wisdom. Yeah, that's just blank mind. Okay, so emptiness is not having a blank mind. Yeah, we have to realize the absence of inherent existence. Okay, so here's a little bit of explanation about the verse. A mind that has no object, okay, that's the first line in the first verse, is a mind that does not grasp any phenomena to have an objectified or inherently existent basis. Okay, so when the first line says, the abiding of a mind that has no object, it doesn't mean blank-minded meditation. There's a mind that just has no object and doesn't think about anything. It means a mind that does not grasp anything as having its own inherent nature inside of it. As long as we believe there is an objectified basis, something that by its own nature is that object, grasping its inherent existence will arise. That this happens is confirmed by the fact that we so quickly react to people, objects, and events with attraction and rejection. Okay? And we do this based on believing that they have their own inherent nature. They exist as self-enclosed, independent things, just as they appear to. Okay? So when we see something, yeah, so we see this, it's not just a cup, but for some people, it is a beautiful cup. Do you think this cup is beautiful? Anybody, you think it's beautiful? Okay. So, it's a beautiful cup. The beauty exists inside this object. Yeah. the beauty has nothing to do with my mind. It has nothing to do with the fact that the lights were on so that I can see the color of the drawing. Yeah, because it's depending on the lights being on, otherwise I couldn't even see it. Okay. But somehow, yeah, this has beauty in it. And I love beautiful things. So I've got to have this cup. Yeah, I've got to have it. Now, you may think I'm a little bit crazy. But let's take an object that you have some attachment towards. How about, are you attached to your car? Yeah, people have got horse cars. Are you attached to your car? Yeah. Okay. So because you see that car as an inherently existing car, and because you think that there's a real me that owns it, and that that car is mine, there is something in that piece of metal with a little bit of plastic and cloth mixed in it that is mine. Yeah. And what else do we impute on the car? Okay. I have a car. That means, yeah, I'm successful. That means I have the freedom to drive anywhere I want to. Okay. That car gives me some kind of power, some kind of status. All of those qualities exist in that car. So I want it. Okay. But do all those qualities, is there real beauty inside that car? What is that car really? It's a hunk of metal with some paint splashed on it. Yeah. And some seats in it. The seats might be made of leather. They might be made of cloth. Yeah. But it's just a bunch of atoms and molecules put together in that shape that functions to take us from one place to the other. That's all it is. There's nothing beautiful in it. But we not only grasp the car as inherently existent, but its beauty as inherent existence. And then what happens when it gets scratched? Have you ever come back to where you parked your car and it's been scratched in the time you were away? What happens then when you see your beautiful new car and there's a big scratch all along the side and you can tell it was made by somebody with a black car? Because the scratch is black. Then what happens? Yeah, what happens inside of you? Do you just say, oh, that's okay? No, you don't say, that's okay. Oh, that's my car. They ruin the beauty of my car. And because it's my car, that means they personally are attacking me. They're not just harming my car, they're harming me. And they can't do that. They didn't even write a note and put it on the on the under the windshield wipers, saying who they are and promising to repair it and leaving their phone number. They didn't even do that. Yeah. And now my beautiful car is scratched. I am so mad. You're so mad that you punch the car and then you have a imprint of your hand in the car. And you also have to go to the doctor because you just broke your fingers. But that's what anger makes us do. Okay. But that's because we're thinking that that car, you know, it really has inherent beauty and value in it. But it doesn't. If we looked at it and said, that's just a bunch of atoms and molecules put together in a certain shape that functions in a certain way, that collectively all of us have agreed to call it by the designation car. If I saw it like that, then I wouldn't be so upset when it got scratched. Okay. Makes some sense to you? Let's try it with a person that you're attached to. Okay, think of a person you are really attached to. You know, it could be your mother or father, boyfriend, girlfriend. Could be your pet frog. Whatever living being you are attached to. Okay. So, what's our living being's name? Give me a name. What? Bobeef? Goldfish. That's a person's name. No, but okay. Your goal. Let's take a person, a human being. Okay. How about what's a common Chinese name? Ming. Okay. So there's Ming. Yeah. And I fell in love with Ming. Oh, he's so wonderful. Everything I always wanted. Good looks, intelligence, athletic, artistic, musical, kind, rich, but that's not really important. But it's... yeah. But so wonderful. Just this wonderful person. Yeah, I never want to be separated from him. Okay? He's really like that. Now, if Ming were really that wonderful, yeah, inherently wonderful, then everybody would see him that way, and I would always see him that way. Yeah, when you first fall in love, it's like that, you know, like this person can't do anything wrong. But wait a little bit. Then the person you think is so kind, so sensitive, so forgiving, so understanding, then some other guy doesn't like him. And says, I had a run-in with Ming, and Ming just was lying, he was conniving, he was cheating, I can't stand that guy. Now, if there was something that were really Ming, that never changed, and he had that inherent essence that was always there, then how could I think he was the best thing in the world and someone else think that he's a total jerk? Yeah? Those two things don't go together. We usually say, well, it's because the other guy's a jerk that he thinks Ming is a jerk. Okay. We usually say that. But let's change the example a little bit. Okay. Ming is so wonderful. Ooh. Yeah? And then I come home and all of his dirty clothes are all over the floor. He gets undressed and he just leaves his clothes on the floor and he expects me to pick them up. Listen, guy, you know, I am not your servant. Yeah. Do not leave your dirty clothes here. This is disrespectful. Yeah. In fact, who do you think you are treating me like your servant? You get really mad. What happened to that Ming that was so wonderful? That was inherently wonderful. What happened to him? Was he really inherently wonderful? If he were, he would have picked up all his laundry himself. He wouldn't leave it on the floor and expect me to be his maid. Okay? So what I'm getting at is our daily life experience actually shows us that things cannot exist as an objectified basis, you know, that is something out there, fixed, independent of everything else. Yeah. But all these things are dependent. Yeah. And how we see them is dependent. And there's no one 100% correct way to see him, because he's changing all the time. And he has many different personality characteristics. Sometimes he's sweet as could be, and other times he's horribly insensitive. Yeah? The person that you're very attached to, do you always think is wonderful? Really? Always? They never do make any mistake? Really? Just wait a little bit. Yeah. Wait till the honeymoon's over. Yeah. Then. Okay. So what we're getting at here, you know, when we talk about, you know, why it's important to realize emptiness is because we can see that when we grasp people and objects as inherently existent, we get attached to them. When we're attached to them, when something happens to them, then we get angry. When there's either attachment or anger in our mind, we create negative karma. Yeah, the seeds of that karma are planted on the mental continuum, or on the person, and we get reborn in samsara. Okay, so this is why realizing emptiness is important, because if we do, then we don't get hung up in all these things. Okay, when you realize emptiness, somebody could swear at you up and down, you know, and call you every name in the book, and it doesn't matter to you, because you know that there's no independent, concrete person that is being insulted. Now, when somebody looks at you and says, "You idiot! How could you do that?" Okay. Yeah. So say somebody says to me, you know, children, you're an idiot. How could you do that? Yeah. Who is the children that they are insulting? Who exactly are they insulting? Are they insulting this, my arm? They're insulting my arm when they say, you're an idiot? No, my arm's just here. It's not an idiot. Are you an idiot? No. Okay. Are they insulting my teeth? Or my eyes? No, they aren't insulting any part of my body, actually. Yeah. What about my mind? You idiot, how could you do that? Are they insulting my mind? Which mind? The visual consciousness, the auditory consciousness, the mental consciousness? Yeah. There are lots of different consciousnesses. Are they insulting the sleeping mind, the waking mind, the happy mind, the miserable mind? You can't say they're insulting my mind. Yeah. And my mind is, you know, not an idiot. So exactly who is the recipient of this insult? Why do I get so upset when somebody calls me an idiot or a jerk? Who exactly are they saying that is? Okay. So when we have an understanding of emptiness, we relax about a lot of things. Okay? We don't take things so seriously. Yeah. And we don't worry so much, and we aren't so anxious. Now, I realize in Singapore, people love to worry. Yeah. Yeah. You love to be anxious. No, you don't actually love to be anxious, but you're pretty habituated with being anxious. You know, everybody here is like vibrating all the time. You know, anxiety, fear, I'm going to lose my job, I'm not going to get the promotion, my boss is criticizing me, this person doesn't like me, oh, what's happening, I don't fit in, nobody likes me, what am I going to do, I'm not making enough money, I'm making too much money, I don't know what to do with it. Yeah, everybody's just, you know, I'm worried about my car, I'm worried about my notebook, I'm worried about my house, I'm worried about my child, I'm worried about the birds that fly in the sky, except when they poop on me, then I don't worry about them anymore. You know, yeah, this all happens because we make everything so solid. Okay, so I went over time. Oh no, she went over time. Ah, oh, you mean I can finally get out of this place? Okay. So there's one question that I just thought I would answer very quickly. Yeah, so it's from somebody who has cancer, and they say, you know, I've accepted my situation and my condition, but will you please talk a little bit about the Buddhist perspective of saying that, you know, this is a result of negative karma ripening, and that I should rejoice at the karma ripening. And, you know, that having an illness like this isn't really something awful. Okay? You know, because when you first get your cancer diagnosis, you kind of freeze and you think, you know, I'm going to be dead by next Tuesday. And, you know, Tuesday comes and Tuesday goes and you're still here. Okay, so what the Buddhist teachings on this means is when we get ill, yeah, there's many causes and conditions. There might be a virus, there might be bacteria. With cancer, you know, the cells are, for some inexplicable reason, they don't understand, are multiplying in a way that they shouldn't do. So there's many causes and conditions for illness. And one of the causes and conditions is our own negative actions. Okay, this does not mean we deserve to be sick. Repeat, it does not mean we deserve to be sick. Okay, it means that in some time, either early this life or probably a previous life, yeah, we engaged in some kind of negative behavior. Yeah, and that planted a seed in our mind stream, and then that is ripening by our getting sick. Yeah, everybody here gets sick. Anybody here who's never been sick their whole life? You know, cancer is one sickness, but there's a whole bunch of other ones. Some are more serious, some are less serious. But usually when we get sick, we go, oh, woe is me, I feel terrible. What did I do to deserve this? This isn't fair. We're miserable. I mean, we have physical pain, yeah, but then our mind jumps in and creates a whole lot of mental pain in addition to it. Oh, I'm sick, I can't do this, I can't do that. I used to be able to do this and that, but now I can't, and woe is me. Okay, and you get depressed or you get angry at the sickness, whatever it is, yeah? But if you think this is a product of my own negative behavior, yeah, and this kind of karma could have brought about a very serious or could have brought a lower rebirth in which I would have experienced much more severe suffering than what I'm going through right now. If you think like that, then you think, oh, actually it's not so bad that I'm sick because I'm burning up all that negative karma. And so now it cannot ripen in a lower rebirth. Okay. And then you compare the suffering that you have being sick with the suffering of a lower rebirth. And you see, it's not that bad. I can actually endure it. Yeah. And then your mind changes. Your mind is much more accepting, much more peaceful. Every time there's some kind of pain, you say to yourself, I'm purifying, I'm happy that I'm purifying. Okay, I'll tell you one story and then I really will stop. Okay, so one of my Dharma friends was doing retreat at Kopan, the monastery in Nepal. And she developed a very big boil on her cheek. And boils can be really painful. So she was walking around the monastery one day. She was on a break between her meditation sessions, and she's walking around. And she bumps into Lama Zopa, okay? And Rinpoche looks at her and says, how are you? And she says, I have this horrible boil, and it's big, and it's painful, and I'm going to have to, you know, go to the doctor, and they're going to have to cut it open. And Rinpoche looked at the boil and said, Good. Good. Wonderful. You're so fortunate. You know, she just wanted some sympathy. Yeah. Somebody say, oh, you poor thing, you know, oh, poor you. And instead he says, that's wonderful. You know, this is some negative karma that could have ripened in your being born in the hell realm for eons, and it's now ripening as a boil. You are so fortunate. Really? Unfortunate? But she started, you know, to think that way, and it changed the experience. Yeah.